The headlines, the International Court of Justice is set to hold its first hearing in a case brought against Israel for committing genocide in the besieged Gaza Strip. Israel intensifies its airstrikes and ground incursions in the Gaza Strip as a UN agency issues a fresh warning about the humanitarian situation in Gaza. And Yemen slams a UN Security Council resolution on anti-Israeli operations in the Red Sea, saying all its actions fall within the framework of legitimate defense. Hello and welcome, everybody. The International Court of Justice in The Hague will hold its first hearing to consider its provisional measures on a lawsuit filed by South Africa against the Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip. Both the plaintiff and the defendant will face each other at the top UN court today. Judges will hear the case that accuses the Tel Aviv regime of genocide against Palestinians and also requests an emergency suspension of Israel's war on Gaza. The ICJ will have 2 days of hearings in the case this week. Israel is accused of failing to uphold its obligations under the 1948 Genocide Convention. Many countries, including Iran, have voiced their support for the case. Also, over 900 popular movements, unions, political parties, and civil organizations have signed an open letter calling on world states to support the genocide case against Israel. Latifa Wuchakra joins us now from The Hague with more details on today's hearing. Latifa, what do you have to share with us?
Thank you. Of course, as mentioned earlier, the overwhelming support for the people of Palestine and the South African legal team is undeniable. The amount of people that have gathered here, not just natives of Holland, but also people from all over the world that have come to witness this historic case. The significance of this moment cannot be overstated. We are considering a former apartheid state, the applicant here, South Africa, taking the last remaining apartheid state in the world to court to face accountability for 75 years of genocide.
And Latifa, what will a potential court ruling look like in terms of the pressure that it can pile on the Israelis? International pressure is already increasing by the second with regards to the bloodbath that the Israelis have created in Gaza.
So a positive result here for South Africa will mean that the United Nations will be able to put sanctions on Israel. On the apartheid state of Israel. What that means is that all member states of the United Nations will have a duty to impose these sanctions, whether it be trade, any allies, anyone who is complicit with the genocide of the Palestinians will also face sanctions, things like the vetoing of any resolutions by America at the Security Council will be made null and void, and therefore international pressure will mount over Israel.
All right, thanks a lot. Latifa Wuchakra joining us from outside The Hague. Elsewhere, pro-Palestinian groups in South Africa have voiced their support for the country's genocide lawsuit at the International Court of Justice. Let's take a listen to the reactions of one of the activists.
In this instance, the Zionist state has really transgressed all the principles, all the sort of the clauses that basically speak out against any form of genocide. They've just done a textbook text in the sense of they've just, you know, blindly and arrogantly basically been pushing their own story. They talk about human rights for themselves, but the human rights that are committed against the Palestinians, they don't even, it's silence. And if anybody, if you and I speak out against the injustice that they commit, then they say we are anti-Semitic. Where does anti-Semitism fit into this picture? It doesn't. They are anti-Semitic as Zionists.
Israel has launched fresh airstrikes on the Gaza Strip as the genocidal war enters its 97th day. The latest attacks targeted the city of Rafah and the Maghazi refugee camp in southern Gaza. At least 7 people were killed in the city of Khan Yunis. Over 23,300 Palestinians have been killed and nearly 60,000 wounded since October the 7th. Most of the casualties are women and children. The World Health Organization has called the humanitarian situation in Gaza indescribable. It says there are still insurmountable challenges to delivering humanitarian aid in the territory, according to the WHO, intense Israeli bombardment, restrictions on movement, fuel shortages, and interrupted communications make it impossible to reach those in need. Joining us from San Francisco, we have political commentator Scott Bennett to offer us some more insight on the upcoming ICJ hearing. Mr. Bennett, what are your expectations for the ICJ hearing?
Well, if there's justice in the world, then of course people should be praying to God for justice, for His justice to be visited upon the wicked. If there is justice, God is going to be involved in this, I think this could be a turning point. This could be a moment where the world rises up in one voice and says in very emphatic terms that is supposed to embody justice and equality and the rule of law, that these actions by Israel amounts to genocide, torture, and something that we have not witnessed, I think, really in the history of mankind. I think this is the most terrible slaughter of innocents that has ever occurred in history. And my heart is always in pain over this, as I know millions of other people are, Americans and Christians alike, and Europeans alike, and of course, the Muslim and Arab world. So in one sense, I hope for the best, but I'm also not naive to not understand that the CIA and the Mossad and the Shin Bet, the Israeli intelligence services and the British often blackmail and control some of these institutions, whether it's the IMF, the World Bank, the United Nations, or in this case, the International Criminal Court. There's a very good chance that this will be manipulated, as the Western intelligence agencies have done, and they will seek to extinguish this entire proceeding, at which case it will simply demonstrate to the world there is no justice that can be coming out of the International Criminal Court. It is a stooge, it's a puppet, it's worthless, and it's about time that the entire Muslim, Arab, African, Malaysian, Middle East world turns away from these institutions, because they're nothing but corrupt agents of murder and bloodshed. If they do not rise and emphatically stop this bloodshed. So in one sense, I'm very proud that the South Africans have demonstrated this courage. I think it opens up the opportunity for nations all over the world to file amicus briefs. And an amicus brief is simply a friend of the court brief that confirms and makes a similar argument that this is a crime against humanity. And what the Israelis are doing are not defending Israeli people or the government. The Israelis are engaging in a political agenda of slaughter in order to capture territory and transform that territory's natural resources into enrichment for the Israeli Zionist apartheid regime. And Netanyahu has done this to extend his own political life. Indeed, you could make the argument that the entire October 7th invasion of Israel, they claim, you could make an argument that this was partly planned by Israel. They'd been planning this for a while. They had also embedded agents in the Hamas organization. So I wouldn't be surprised if that kind of an argument is put forth, that Israel has been planning this for a long time, and it involves a variety of other actions, but it is in no way anything other than absolute genocide and the murder of women and children. And like I said, if there's any justice, then we'll see that. And if there's not a swift condemnation of Israel, then I think that shows the world that this institution is worthless and should be turned away from.
Thanks a lot, sir. Political commentator Scott Bennett joining us from San Francisco. The World Health Organization has called the humanitarian situation in Gaza indescribable, nearly 100 days into the U.S.-Israeli genocide across the territory. WHO chief says there are still insurmountable challenges to delivering humanitarian aid in Gaza. Tedros Adhanom says intense Israeli bombardment restrictions on movement, fuel shortages, and interrupted communications make it impossible to reach those in need. His remarks come as the Israeli regime keeps pounding the blockaded territory with airstrikes and artillery fire. Hospitals, ambulances, and medical staff are prime targets of the regime's relentless bombardments. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society says an Israeli strike on an ambulance in central Gaza has killed four medics and two other people inside the vehicle. UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs has warned that attacks on hospitals and medical facilities will lead to the destruction of Gaza's health sector. According to the health ministry, Israel committed 14 massacres across Gaza in the past 24 hours, killing at least 147 civilians. More than 23,300 Palestinians have so far been killed in Gaza since October the 7th. Sandal Salassad is a journalist and commentator based in Beirut. She says the Israeli regime has failed to achieve any of its goals in its genocidal war against Gaza.
The Israeli army is weak and is fragile and has nothing to do but genocides and ethnic cleansing, and has been trying since the beginning of the war to fabricate any sort of victory just to save and to secure to burnish its image, actually. So this hasn't helped it. In addition to this aggression by the United States, actually the United States itself is launching this war against Gaza and against South Lebanon. So this aggression has failed to achieve any of its goals, and the only thing that they have been able to do is been and attacking the civilians and the civilian facilities.
Well, more than 3 months of relentless Israeli airstrikes and shelling have displaced almost the entire population of the besieged Gaza Strip. The displaced Palestinians are struggling with the lack of basic supplies. Let's take a listen to some of the people who describe their terrible conditions in a refugee camp in Rafah.
We lost hope. We've been listening to the news for 98 days, hoping that the war will end. But due to this difficult situation, we see no hope, especially that we don't have water nor electricity. Due to the lack of water, we shower just once per month. Psychologically, we are suffering, and the diseases have spread everywhere.
It's not 100 days. It felt like 100 years. We weren't living during these 100 days. Some are living on the streets. Some are in the north and others in Rafah. Some are living in schools. Some on the streets, on the floors, and others sleeping on benches. The war has not spurred anyone.
We lost all of our dreams. We, as young women, we dreamed of getting a job, of studying. The children may lose years of their lives living here. Some went to schools, others were in kindergarten. It was all for nothing. Everything is lost.
We lost our money, our houses, our jobs. We are losing our youths as well. We have sacrificed all of this for our homeland. We have sacrificed our children for our homeland.
Moving on with the news, Yemen has slammed a UN Security Council resolution condemning the Yemeni armed forces' anti-Israeli operations in the Red Sea, calling it, quote, a political game. Senior member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mohammed Ali Al-Houthi, said it's the United States that is actually violating international law. He said the Security Council must take steps to immediately end the Israeli-American siege of over 2 million Palestinians in Gaza. Houthi noted that all actions taken by the Yemeni armed forces are within the framework of legitimate defense. He also warned that any action taken by the U.S. and its allies in the Red Sea following the adoption of the resolution will have a reaction. His comments came after the Security Council demanded an immediate end to Yemeni attacks on ships in the Red Sea, urging the Ansar Allah movement to immediately stop all such attacks.
In retaliation for a U.S. deadly attack on Yemeni naval forces that took place last month, Yemen's armed forces have carried out a joint military operation against an American ship in the Red Sea. The spokesman for the Yemeni armed forces, Yahya Saria, said the ship, which was targeted with ballistic missiles and drones, was supporting Israel.
The naval forces, the missile force, and unarmed air force of the Yemeni armed forces carried out a joint military operation with a large number of ballistic and naval missiles and drones, targeting an American ship that was providing support to the Zionist entity. The operation came as an initial response to the treacherous attack on our naval forces by the American enemy forces.
On December 31st, 10 Yemeni naval forces were killed in a US attack in the Red Sea after successfully preventing an Israeli-linked vessel from heading to a port in occupied Palestine. Yemeni armed forces have been conducting operations against Israeli-linked ships in the area in retaliation for the regime's genocidal war on Gaza that began in October. Officials say the military operation that targeted the US vessel is the beginning of a new phase of Yemen's retaliatory attacks in support of Palestinians. They added, Washington, a staunch ally of Israel, should expect more similar assaults as the Yemeni army has vowed to continue supporting Palestinians.
As mentioned in the Yemeni Armed Forces statement, this operation is an initial response to the Americans and their intervention in the Red Sea to protect ships heading to the Israeli ports, and there will be other responses that will follow this operation. The Yemeni leadership has vowed that it'll retaliate against the Americans, and they should expect other operations soon.
The U.S. has formed a naval coalition to purportedly safeguard commercial traffic in the Red Sea last month. That's while Yemen has stressed that ships that have no connection to Israel can safely sail in the region. Yemen said its anti-Israel operations will continue despite the U.S. move.
Experts say the Yemeni armed forces' recent operation has proven that it is prepared for all options. They warn that the U.S. acts of aggression against the Yemeni forces could spark a regional war. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Leaders meeting with a large group of women on the eve of birthday anniversary of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. On Wednesday, 27th of December, with only a week to go until the birth anniversary of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, a day celebrated in the Islamic Republic of Iran as Women's Day, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with a large group of women from all walks of life. At this meeting, which was held in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in Tehran, the leader talked about the qualities and characteristics of Hazrat Fatima Zahra and a range of topics and issues relating to women. In this program, we discuss the leader's remarks and points of view expressed at this meeting. Stay with us. On Wednesday, 27th of December, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with a large group of women from all walks of life. The meeting was held on the occasion of the upcoming birth anniversary of Sadiqat al-Kubra, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. Commenting on Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, the leader said, "Regarding the Lady of the Worlds and the Lady of the Women of Paradise, which are terms that have been used to describe Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, anything that the Holy Prophet, the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, or the rest of the Imams, peace be upon them, have said about this venerable woman are all testaments to the immeasurable greatness of this individual. In other words, the magnificence of Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, cannot be compared to any human being except the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt, or members of the household of the Prophet, the Messenger of God himself and his children. Her status is indeed unique and very high indeed." According to the famous hadith narrated by both Shia and Sunni scholars, "Indeed, God is angered when Fatima is angered, and God is pleased when Fatima is pleased." The leader added, what this means is that any human being, or any Muslim for that matter, who wishes to please God, they must do something to please Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. If the advice, recommendations, teachings, orientations, and the emotions of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, are respected and observed, then the Almighty will be pleased. What virtue greater than this can a person imagine for a human being, either a male or a female? Further remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said, a Muslim woman cannot find a better role model than Lady Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her. No woman in the world can find a better role model than her. Her conduct during her childhood, during her adolescence, during her youth, her conduct in the family, towards her father, her spouse, her children, towards those who worked in her household, and her conduct in society, in politics, and with regards to the issue of the caliphate, are all examples that we should follow. And what's important is that all of these examples were seen during her relatively short lifetime, which was 25 years at most. Our dear women in our Islamic society should try to follow Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, with the same spirit and the same determination, both in terms of being a housewife and also when undertaking social and political activities. They should also follow her in terms of her wisdom and knowledge, which in her case was God-given. But you and me need to learn and gain such wisdom and knowledge. Turning to women's issues, Ayatollah Khamenei said, the questions of women's identity, women's values, rights, duties, freedoms and limitations are all crucial and pivotal matters. Today, if we take an overall look at the world, we will see there are two distinct schools of thought or two distinct approaches to these matters. The first one is the prevalent Western approach, which has gained popularity in non-Western countries as well. The second approach is the Islamic approach, and these two approaches are in contrast to one another and diametrically oppose one another. However, there is one issue here which I believe deserves our attention, and that is Western culture and Western civilization is not willing to discuss these matters in a logical manner. It tries to avoid discussion in general and research in women's issues. The West system of civilization and culture instead tries to promote its own viewpoint about women through controversial means, using the arts, using the movie industry, coercion, cyberspace, and such things. Not having a logical reasoning, it promotes its own opinions and approaches using the various tools at its disposal. It is not willing to take part in discussions, nor is it prepared to answer questions. The reason for this is that the West has no logical reasoning with regards to treatment of women. The West refuses to discuss this matter and is unwilling to provide any reasoning for its actions. Why is it that women in Western society are disrespected more and more every day? Why is it that a scantily clad woman can attend official gatherings and functions in the West that are functions that are held in Europe and the United States, but a man must be fully clothed to attend the same gatherings and the same functions? In formal or official gatherings, men are expected to wear a suit with a tie or a bow tie in order to participate. Why are promiscuity and prostitution being promoted more and more in Western societies? This is happening today. Why is homosexuality regarded to be a sophisticated, progressive practice in the West? And why is it that if some individual or some country opposes homosexuality, they are considered to be a backward individual with a backward mindset or a backward country. Commenting further, the leader said, "Why some Western presidents and Western officials in some countries promote homosexuality and some are even proud of it. Why? What is the logic behind this? Why is this, according to the statistics that Western countries report themselves and based on the information that is publicly available, three-sided or four-sided sexual relations are increasing by the day in Western societies. Everything that destroys families is increasing day by day in the West. All of these things destroy the family foundation. A few years ago, I quoted some words from a book written by former US President Jimmy Carter. The book was called A Call to Action. The statistics regarding sexual assault and promiscuity in Western societies were truly horrific, and there is no punishment for sexual assault. But those who choose to wear a hijab in the West are punished. In one word, briefly, I would like to summarize the outcome and basis of Western civilization's policy and outlook with regards to the very important issue of women. The Western outlook can be summarized in two factors: seeking profit and seeking pleasure from women. So that is the Western approach with regards to the issue of women. There is no logic behind it, and it cannot be defended. Islam's outlook, however, is the exact opposite of the Westerner outlook. It is based on logic and reasoning, and clear statements have been made in this regard. The issue of women is one of the strong points of Islam. Some shouldn't imagine that we must just sit around and answer for women's issues. Islam has a strong logic and rationale for all matters relating to women. Islam completely disregards a person's gender in some cases. That is, the discussion is not about male or female. It is about honoring human beings. An ayah in the Holy Quran says, "We have honored the children of Adam." Gender does not matter in this case. Human values are the same for both men and women. Gender is not an issue at all when talking about the value of a woman compared to the value of a man. But the faithful men and women are comrades of one another. They bid what is right and forbid what is wrong. Indeed, Muslim men and Muslim women, the faithful men and faithful women, the obedient men and obedient women. And this is another verse from Surah Al-Ahzab in the Holy Quran. Commenting further on the issue of women, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "As for the duties within the family, men and women have different obligations. Each gender is assigned a different set of responsibilities according to the resources that are available to them and according to their physical and mental abilities. This is where gender does play a role. Crying out for gender equality is absolutely wrong here. Gender equality does not apply everywhere. In some places, yes, it does apply, but in other places, it does not. What is correct to say is gender justice. Gender justice is applicable everywhere. Justice means ensuring that everything is in its own place. The spiritual, physical, and emotional framework of a woman allows her to do certain things. Having children, taking care of children, and raising children is a responsibility specifically entrusted to women, as men are not capable of fulfilling this role within the family. The Almighty has not created men for this task. Men have been designed for other tasks, such as the work outside of the home, and addressing the problems that may arise within the home. However, in terms of the rights within a family unit, both genders are equal. And women have rights similar to the obligations upon them, in accordance with honourable norms. In other words, women have the same number of rights within a family unit that men have. This is a verse from the Holy Quran. Thus, they're equal when it comes to family rights, but they're not equal in their responsibilities. Of course, there are some things that should be paid more attention to about women, and some of these were also mentioned. An example is the issue of women's safety, their safety within the family unit. A woman should feel safe and secure within the family unit, and whenever she is with her husband. Their home should be a place where they can feel safe and comfortable. If the man of the house behaves in a way that deprives the woman of a sense of security, if he causes the woman to feel unsafe, if he uses foul language, or if he is violent towards her, these actions are absolutely unacceptable. What is the solution to this problem? The answer is to impose strict laws. I have said this many times before, strict laws must be imposed. A man who creates an unsafe environment for his wife, both within and outside the confines of their home, should be severely punished. Another issue is working in society and managerial positions for women. Gender does not enter into this issue. There are no limits to the presence of women in various managerial positions, or in various positions in society and within the government. Commenting further about women, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, "There are two important points according to Islam's point of view. Women are free to be active in all fields, such as being active in society and being active in politics, within the government, etc. However, this should take place while remembering two important points, which Islam is sensitive about. The first is the issue of family. The second is the potential dangers associated with sexual attraction. The danger of sexual attraction, Islam is sensitive about this point. Islam forbids us from preparing the environment and the atmosphere in such a way that individuals will go astray, which is one of the most dangerous areas. Because of this, Islam requires women to wear hijab. The issue of hijab is one of the things that can limit the danger of sexual attraction. This is why Islam emphasizes hijab. The issue of hijab is mentioned in two places in Surah Al-Ahzab in the Holy Quran, when it says, "When you ask his women folk for something, do so from behind a curtain." And the issue of hijab is also mentioned in another verse from Surah Al-Ahzab in the Holy Quran. Therefore, these two concerns need to be taken into account. The issue of hijab should be observed in the true sense of the word, and the issue of family, a woman's presence within the family unit and within the home, and her role as a mother, which is the most important role, should be taken into account. Perhaps I can say that motherhood is the most important role within the world of creation. This is because without motherhood, without the birth of children, and without pregnancies and breastfeeding, the human race would cease to exist. Therefore, motherhood is the most important role in the world of creation and for humans' material existence. Islam places importance on this point. I also encourage you to give importance to this matter, and the same applies to the point I mentioned earlier about sexual attraction and the issue of hijab. Many tasks at home should be performed based on mutual understanding. Some people think that working in the home is a woman's duty, but no, working in the home is definitely not a woman's duty. It is not a woman's duty to cook food, wash clothes, or clean. Men and women must come to an understanding with each other, and they must collaborate in household chores. Fortunately, some men do this. They work in the home as well and help their wives. They take care of some household chores. And this is to be valued. Commenting further, the leader said, Islamic scholars emphasize that the age of getting married should not go up very much and that young people should get married. Marriage at an appropriate time for adolescents, for young people, for both men and women is essential. Therefore, when considering the issue of hijab, it should not be viewed as a means of restricting women. It is not a means for deprivation. On the contrary, hijab is actually a blessing that brings security, safety and protection for women. At the end of his remarks, the leader wished success and prosperity for all the women present. He said, May God's greetings, mercy and blessings be upon all of you.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. has been assisting and even masterminding the Israeli regime's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. But is the U.S. playing a duplicitous role, like when it asked the Israeli regime to prevent civilian deaths, especially women and children, and yet it assisted with all types of military equipment, including bombs and missiles? Or when it says that the Gaza Strip will not be occupied again by Israel, and there will be no forced displacement of Palestinians, war crime, yet it has discussed placing Palestinians in Egypt and Jordan? In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the U.S. role, especially the future of Palestinians, in which it is reported that the U.S. has talked to a number of regional Arab countries and wants Israel's Muslim-majority neighbors to play a role in the Strip's future governance. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Mick Napier, co-founder of the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, and joins us from Edinburgh. Also joining us, Alberto Garcia Watson, a political analyst and activist from Malaga in Spain. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Mick Napier, first to you. Taking a look at the U.S. role is our focus in some regards. I'm wondering what it is that it's doing. It's rather duplicitous, as I said in the intro. I mean, it announces, for example, publicly Israel needs to decrease the number of civilian deaths. Precautionary measures need to take place, but at the same time it provides it with unfettered access to all types of military equipment, not to mention the fact that you have about 40 to 42% of the bombs that the U.S. has provided are unguided. It means they drop it anywhere without it going anywhere, and it kills lots of civilians, which means maximum deaths. How do you view this type of approach by the U.S.?
Well, it's straightforward support for genocide. It's not the first time the U.S. government has publicly supported genocide without using the word, but it's ongoing and we can see it on TV. The words that they use are a thin veneer to try to give their Arab allies in Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and Morocco and so on some kind of suggestion that they might be balancing, that they might want a kinder, gentler genocide, possibly, that Israel should try to reduce the killing rate for children from tens of thousands of children and women to a smaller number, but still high. But the words also that Blinken used today was that Israel must readmit the Palestinians it's displacing. He added, when security conditions permit, and those security conditions will be decided by Israel. Look, this is a cynical game which really everybody who's studied it knows what's going on. America, from time to time, when its attack dog in the Middle East behaves particularly savagely, and it plays very badly with American public opinion, they sometimes have to use a which to cover up that. But essentially, America is at the moment completely committed to Israel. It's got warships there, it has aircraft carriers, it may even, according to some rumors, have special forces on the ground helping their allies in Gaza, but it's four square in support of Israel. Look, in the past, America had to say, we support this country because it's a democracy. It didn't matter if it was a democracy or not, but that's what the claim was.
Sure.
But now, around the world, millions of Americans can see that America, despite the words, is absolutely committed to genocide, and it's causing a big crisis inside Biden's own party.
Well, let's expand on that a little bit more here, Alberto, if we can, in terms of the U.S. role, and not just in the confines of we're giving them military assistance, which they don't even really acknowledge as much as they used to before, but that they are actually an active participant when it comes to the war planning, perhaps, or providing intel, or, as our guests there indicated, that there's special op operatives that are on the ground, which shows the extent that the U.S. is involved in, which has led many to conclude the U.S. is an active participant in the war strategy, in the genocidal war strategy that's being executed on the Gaza Strip. What do you think?
Well, definitely the United States is involved in this war, like it's been involved in so many other wars around the world in the past decades. But here it's clearly obvious that without the American help, the Israelis will be very much in trouble. As a matter of fact, at this point, Israel is in panic, and that's why they had to call basically for help to the United States, involving other countries like Syria, like Yemen, like the Lebanese Hezbollah militias, trying to involve them in the way that United States gets involved also. So it's actually very, very clear that without United States support, and not just in weapons, but the moral support and the obvious support in the and the United Nations Security Council with their veto, Israel feels extremely strong and impune, like it's always been for the past seven decades.
Sure.
And that is very, very clear for the Israelis. Without America, actually, Israel would not even exist today.
Why would you say Israel is in trouble? I think I heard you there.
Well, definitely it's in trouble because the situation now at this point, after 3 months of war, is that Hamas is basically intact in the Gaza Strip, and they have a lot of losses. And the whole world is at this moment knocking at Israel's door.
Let's capitalize on that then with you, McNabb, here. If after, we were approaching 100 days, I think in a matter of a few days on Sunday, it's going to be 100 days of nonstop bombing practically, correct? And we know what the goal and intention and intent of the Israeli regime forces are. But they have realized that they can't do that perhaps way before the 100 days is due. And at this point, they realize that. And I'm sure the U.S. Realizes that. Why are they continuing with the bombing campaign? Why are they still murdering Palestinians?
Because that's the only thing they can do. You're right, 100 days. Where are the photographs? I mean, the information which Israel has produced for world opinion about mass Hamas surrenders, about massive armaments found under hospitals and so on. Even the BBC is refusing to accept that at face value, and that's quite new. The fact is, they can kill tens of thousands of civilians, but they are not defeating the Palestinian resistance at the moment. There are no photographs of surrenders. 100 days is a remarkable achievement against the most high-tech army in the region and possibly in the whole world. So, you know, for Israel to win, they have to crush Hamas, and Hamas has to be defeated, which is inconceivable because Hamas represents the resistance spirit of the Palestinian people at the moment. But for the Palestinians to win, for guerrillas to win, for irregular fighters to win, all they have to do is survive. And they're surviving. They are not being defeated. They have to take significant losses, even terrible losses, in terms of the civilian population. But that's just the history of fighting colonialism in Algeria or Vietnam or any other country. Terrible, terrible costs and women and children and ordinary civilians being slaughtered. But that's the fight against colonialism. Israel's not winning. The resistance is winning by the normal calculus of asymmetric warfare. And it's absolutely remarkable. Nobody could have imagined this on October the 6th, that Hamas and the Jihad and other factions would score such a classic military victory against the much vaunted Israeli army. And why are they carrying on the bombing? Because they were defeated on October the 6th. They suffered a terrible defeat, maybe even bigger than they did in 2006 with Hezbollah. And the only way they can try to erase that from popular memory is through mass killing. Sure. Now, remember, an Israeli minister years ago promised the Palestinians in Gaza what he called a Holocaust, a Shoah, and there have been many threats to reduce Palestine to the Stone Age. They're simply doing what they want to do, but it's really to cover up the shame of what happened after October the 7th when they were defeated.
Well, when we take a look at what occurred just a few weeks back, and I'd like for you to put that into context for us, Alberto. That is the fact that you have the U.S. National Security Advisor who has come down visiting Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and, of course, the Minister of Military Affairs, saying that we have to make sure that Israel goes from high-intensity warfare to low-intensity warfare so that it would prevent the high number of civilians that are being killed. That was a few weeks ago. And combining that with the fact that the U.S. has used its veto power at the U.N., which prevented a ceasefire from happening, there hasn't been a day, perhaps every other day, at a minimum, where we're looking at hundreds of Palestinians being killed. I mean, that's almost become a normal. And from then until this point, there could have been a prevention of all these lives, Palestinian lives being lost. What does that say then about the U.S. role again?
Well, the U.S. at this point is interested in the amount of deaths not to be shown in TV. It's actually an embarrassment that the United States is providing weapons and support to Israel in this slaughter that is going on in the Gaza Strip. Let's not forget that in a few months it starts a presidential election campaign in the United States, and the popularity of Biden has gone really down the drain. Thanks to this conflict and thanks to this support. Here we're talking about over 50,000 tons of bombs thrown in the Gaza Strip, which represents even more explosives thrown in the two atomic attacks in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. United States cannot keep up with these numbers showing. They don't care about the amount of casualties. What they care is about the repercussions that this will take politically for the presidential career of Biden next year.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Whenever this subject comes up, McNapp, here, I don't know about you and what impression you have versus Palestinian lives. Nevertheless, let's take a look at this ICJ case that South Africa has pressed and has submitted the genocide that Israel has committed. There's lots of support that's come out. Many countries are supporting it, many organizations at the same time. But it's interesting the way that the U.S. has reacted to this, which, using Anthony Blinken's words, meritless, counterproductive, and completely without any basis in fact whatsoever. He could have done a better job trying to make a convincing case here, but he really, I mean, what do you think? What's your reaction to it?
No, I disagree with you. I don't think he could have made a more convincing case. You know, in a, if you're playing a game of cards, you don't have to be a great player if you've got a fantastic hand. And however good a player you are, if you've got rubbish in your hands, you can't win. And how could he possibly defend the first genocide that's being played out on American television? He simply couldn't. So it now goes to the Supreme, it now goes to the International Court of Justice. And what can he say? I mean, it's genocide. It's the South African government, which has huge moral credibility internationally because of the fight against the apartheid regime there. And it's them against the Israelis. It's, you know, there's no competition. In terms of worldwide public opinion, Israel can only lose. I mean, what can the judges say? It's okay to kill 500 people in a hospital. It's okay to force a situation where surgeons have to amputate the limbs of their children without anaesthetic because Israel allows a few trucks into Gaza, but they removed the anaesthetic from the trucks. The bestiality, the depravity. I mean, I can hardly find the language to describe the crimes of Israel against the Palestinian people. And I'm not, this is not out of step with world opinion. So, no, I disagree with you respectfully. I don't think that Blinken could possibly make a case, you know, for such diabolical behavior.
I need to get a reaction from you also on that. If that's okay, Alberto, in terms of the way that Blinken has come out, making a statement which obviously the facts speak otherwise, especially as our guests there indicated, everybody around the world has seen the genocide take place on their TV screens.
No, absolutely. If the Americans believe that actually nobody's watching, they're actually very, very wrong. What's going on is even convincing people that had not much of an opinion in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that what's going on and what has been going on for the past 75 years is genocide. And genocide should be punished. And South Africa has taken the initiative that many countries are following. And not just some third world countries. We see even that the Vice Prime Minister of Belgium, Petra de Sutter, is calling for his own government to also press charges in the international court. But even in Spain, here in this country, we have political parties that belong to the coalition that is governing in Spain that are asking, trying to convince the Spanish president to also press charges in the international criminal court. So the whole world is watching. Blinken cannot just put away with just some sweet words as he usually does. This is his fifth visit to Israel and to the region. And basically what he's trying every single time is to rescue Israel from the situation that is suffering now, which I mentioned earlier, is all these different nations and militias getting involved and most probably getting probably eventually Iran involved directly and not through proxy groups into this war. And that's why Blinken has to every single time come to rescue them. But Blinken cannot keep on with this speech of clearly deciding for Israel and minimizing the genocide that is unfolding at this moment.
Another one of the things that is at least out in the public is contradictory between the Israeli regime and the U.S. McNabb here is the future of the Palestinians. Netanyahu has admitted very recently that he wants the expulsion of the Gazan population, where he called it voluntary migration. I'm not too sure what's voluntary when you have starvation, airstrikes, diseases, and bullets or bombs being dropped on you. But the U.S., it appears, has other plans based on the visit by Blinken. He has said that he's talked to regional Arab countries, and he wants them to play a role in the governance of the Gaza Strip. So the first question is, what business is it of Blinken to want and to think that it should play a role in that? And B, what about the difference of approach there between U.S. and the Israeli regime on this issue?
Well, I mean, the language that's used is, you know, diplomatic language often around the world is meant to deceive and to sweeten something that's very ugly. But sometimes it fails because the split between the reality and the terms is just unbridgeable. I mean, when Blinken and his pals talk about, they oppose a ceasefire, they want the murder to continue, they want genocide to continue, so they call it being in favour of a humanitarian pause. Because humanitarian sounds nice, but what they really mean is stopping for an hour or two and then resuming the killing without end. So what we see around the world, I think, is the increasing isolation of America. And it can only deepen in the months and years to come. And I think also we're witnessing the very catastrophic failure of Zionism. Because the Zionists always sold themselves. Well, not sell, they hired themselves. Somebody once said, Zionism is not for sale, it's only for hire. But they tried to hire themselves to the British and to the Americans and even the Turks for a while as a strike force in the Middle East. And if you look at it, they kind of failed most of the time. But after 1967, when they defeated Egypt, Syria and Jordan, after that, American aid went through the roof. And since then, America has pumped military aid into Israel to be its attack dog. But now they've failed. Now they need America to come to support them. They need America to allow them to survive in the region. So what used to be an asset is fast becoming a huge liability. I think we're witnessing a dramatic weakening of the Zionist project, despite their military power at the moment.
Indeed. Well, Alberto, in Iran, the Islamic Republic has obviously been very active when it comes to what has occurred in terms of the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war. On the whole Palestinian issue, the Islamic Republic has been very active. And just today, we had the fifth emergency meeting of the OIC member states and also the first meeting of the Asian Parliamentary Assembly. I don't know if you're aware of that. And there were some, the Iranian parliament speaker put forward some great plans along with, for example, the Indonesian rep and other participants at this conference. And aside from that, the active role that Iran has been playing since the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood has taken place to make sure that this thing proceeds and for there to be some action taken against Israel. What types of impact do you think these types of conferences and Iran's role plays when it comes to safeguarding Palestinians, trying to prevent, at least giving the effort to prevent this genocidal war from going forward, or at least hoping for a ceasefire to even take place at this point?
Well, the Islamic Republic of Iran has shown from day one its support to the Palestinian cause, even opening the first Palestinian embassy ever in history, and definitely Iran providing with weapons and training and logistics to the different groups that are at the moment on the ground battling Israel proves that even though they're not directly involved, to a certain extent they are, because the Houthis, the Shia militias in Iraq, Hezbollah and Hamas would not exist if it wasn't for the support that they received from Iran. So basically Iran represents here basically the dignity of the acts of resistance towards Israel. We see other countries like Jordan, like Egypt, and now even talking with about Saudi Arabia with normalization, it shows Arab not to be really convinced of really getting involved in this war supporting the Palestinians. But yet you always see Iran, as I said, from day one, expressing this support. And as I said, I was for a couple of years in Lebanon, and I got to know pretty well from the inside Hezbollah. And basically Hezbollah, like Hamas, the tunnels, the different strategies militarily, the usage of non-guided drones and missiles, if it wasn't for Iran, it would not exist, definitely.
Sure. Thank you for that. By the way, we don't refer to them as militias. We refer to them as fighters, just so we're clear on that. We're approaching the end of the program here, and Mick Napier, taking a look at the purpose that Blinken has laid out in terms of a statement that he made. He said that he wants to this trip that he made to pave the way for the normalization. But he says it is just as clear that normalization will not be a substitute.